It's so good to see everybody here and have Cody and Jordan back with us safely. And we're going to begin our study this morning with a reading from James chapter 5, the first six verses. If you will turn there and read with me, this is going to be the text for our study this morning. Let's get the Word of God in front of us before we think about it. James chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You've heaped up treasure in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who have mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you. This is some pretty stout language that we have here. And it involves the subject of money. I read about a conversation that occurred one time between F. Scott Fitzgerald, who wrote The Great Gatsby, and Ernest Hemingway. And Fitzgerald said, "You know, Ernest, the rich are different from us." And Hemingway said, "Yes, I know. They have more money than we do." Well, that's certainly one difference between them and us, but there are other differences as well, and James is going to take note of them here in this text. You know, rich people often tend to be very private, almost secretive. They can put up big security walls around their mansions, and they can hire guards, bodyguards, to keep people away from them. And they often operate as much as they can under radar. They don't let you know what they're investing in, what business dealings they've got going on. But they often are very secretive. Maybe they figure the less they say about their money, the better the chance they have of holding on to it. But James here kind of pulls the covers back and shows a very unseemly side to money and to riches. He's going to put a spotlight on wealth in our study today. Let me remind you of our context. Back in chapter 4, verses 6 and 10, we read that God does not like pride. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. The very first blessing Christ pronounced was pronounced on those he referred to as the poor in spirit. And that's just another way of talking about the humble. To be poor in spirit is the attitude of humility that says, "I am nothing, I have nothing, and I can do nothing apart from God." That's what Christ said in John 15, verse 5. "Without me, you can do nothing." A tree branch, a tree limb, can do nothing when it is detached from the tree trunk or from the roots of the tree. For us to be capable of doing anything that bears eternal significance, we must be connected to Christ. Humility is the very opposite of the attitude that Pharaoh had when Moses went down to Egypt and said, "Let my people go." "Well, why should I let them go?" And Moses says, "Because the Lord Jehovah says you should." And Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him?" "Well, who is this guy? Who does he think he is? Who is this God you're talking about that I've never heard of?" And Moses said, "Oh, you don't know who God is?" And Moses then signed Pharaoh up in a correspondence course of 10 lessons. And after Pharaoh completed those lessons, he knew who the Lord was. But the arrogance, "Who does God think he is that I should show him any worship or show him any deference?" is something that God hates. He's calling on us to be humble. And last week I pointed out that James is going to talk about three sins that we can commit against humility. chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, we are sinning against humility when we play God. Chapter 4, verses 13 to 17, we are sinning against humility when we plan for the future without God. And now this morning, the third of these high-risk areas that we all encounter in life, we are sinning against humility when we put trust in a false god. That's how Jesus talked about money. He referred to it as mammon. He was using an Arabic word that meant riches. And he says, we cannot serve God and mammon. We've got to choose between gold or God. And James is going to talk about people in chapter 5 here who ostensibly, outwardly, to all appearances, chose for God, but in fact, in their heart, in their soul, they are serving mammon. They are serving gold. Now, let me offer some general comments about money. Nowhere in the Bible does God condemn the possession of wealth. There is nothing incessantly and innately sinful about money. The sin comes in when the money possesses the man. Not when the man possesses the money, but when money possesses the man. When that happens, every evil in the world becomes possible because the love of money is the root of all evil. All that we've seen in my lifetime, at least, with the decay and the devolution and deterioration of society, all of the perversities and tragedies and the wars and the genocides and the murders and the drug, everything that has occurred in my lifetime can be laid at the feet of one cause, and that is the love of money. When you're trying to figure out something, you look at something going on that you read about in the newspapers and you scratch your head. For the life of you, you can't figure out how something like that could ever happen. Well, it could happen because somebody somewhere along the line loves money. Follow the money. And that will take you to the culprit and the cause nine times, maybe 99.9 times out of 10. When money possesses the man, you have opened the door to every kind of evil. There's nothing innately wrong with possessing a stick of dynamite. But dynamite's a dangerous thing. And if it's not strictly controlled, it can cause a lot of damage. Now, there are four categories of people in regard to money. And we fall into one of these four categories. We probably are not in the category we think we're in, but we are in one of these four categories. Number one is a category of those who are poor without, but who are rich within. They don't have many of this world's goals, but let me restate that. There are those who are poor without and poor within. Not only are they broke outwardly, not only do they not have any material possessions, but inwardly they don't have God. They don't have faith in their life. An example of an individual like this would be the thief on the cross. Not the one we usually refer to as the thief on the cross, but the other one. One of those two men hanging there with Christ became convicted in his heart and said, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Christ says, today you'll be with me in paradise. But there was another thief hanging there. And the Gospels tell us that this man insulted Christ. Hanging there next to him, dying along beside of him, this other thief insulted Christ, blasphemed, railed against him, cursed him. And the thief that was saved that day couldn't believe it. The thief that was saved says to the other, would you listen to what you're saying? We deserve to be hanging here. But this man's done nothing to deserve what's happening to him. When you are poor within, you can be guilty of that derangement syndrome that the Bible calls hatred. You can be so filled with hate, so filled with anger, that you cannot even see the good in the Son of God. Poor without, poor within. I don't think we have anybody here this morning who fits that category. Second category, rich without and rich within. Some very well-known men in the Bible were very wealthy men, like Abraham, like Job. Job was the wealthiest man in the East. He was the billionaire of his day. There was none like him. Joseph of Arimathea was a rich man who turned one of his graves over to Christ to be buried in. Barnabas owned property on Cyprus, and that would be like owning several lots at Malibu in our terminology. Men who had this world's goods but who were rich in their faith toward God. For men like that, to lose everything would mean they lost nothing. Job lost everything, but Job didn't really lose anything. When you're rich within, to lose your riches without, you've really lost nothing of importance. A third category, I don't think we have anybody like that here today either, who are just filthy rich. We've got a lot of people rich within today here, but to be filthy rich without, if you're in that category, you've done a good job of hiding it from me and from the rest of us. But a third group, those who are poor without, but rich within. A man by the name of Lazarus, who was a beggar, body full of sores. The only thing he could eat, the only thing he could afford to eat were crumbs that fell from a rich man's table. And yet when he died, he found out the wealth he really had because he was carried by the angels to Abraham's bosom. Poor without, rich within. And then the fourth category are those who are rich without, but poor within. Herod the Great, he would have been a billionaire in today's economy. But he was as evil could be. Laodicea, the church at Laodicea, a church of believers that boasted how rich they were in Revelation chapter 3. And yet Christ said, you don't know how poor you are. And so we can be wealthy and be a wealthy believer and yet be empty inside. And it's shocking to us, I think, to realize that James is talking primarily here in chapter 5 to people in that last category, to people who had money, to people who were meeting with a Christian fellowship, who were thought to be believers in Christ, but inwardly had become spiritually poor. It's just hard for me to wrap my head around the fact that in the days of the apostles, in the first century, there were Christians and Christian churches who had Church of Christ out front. And they had wealthy people within, but Christ was nowhere to be found. And look what James says in the very first verse of chapter 5. He says, come now. He said the same thing back up in verse 13 of chapter 4. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow. And what this phrase, come now, means is kind of like, oh, come on. Get real. Take a look at what's going on here. Quit fooling yourselves. Come now, you rich. You need to be weeping and howling. If you were looking clearly at yourself, at your situation in life, you would be weeping, you would be crying, you'd be howling because of the fate you're headed toward, because of what is coming on you. James talks about how these people had been living in pleasure. They were living in pleasure. And we saw back in chapter 4 early on there in verse 1 and verse 3 that it's the desire for pleasure and indulging earthly physical appetites that lead to wars. And here's a group of Christians, chapter 5, who had accumulated enough money where they could have everything their heart desired. They were fat cats. And James says, would you look, come now, would you look at what you've really got in the bank? When a person is rich, what do they really have? James tells us. Look at verse 3. He says, your gold and silver... Well, let me start at verse 2. He says, your riches are corrupted. Your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded. When a guy's got a big pile of gold, when he's got stocks and bonds, when he's got property, when he has a big bank account, what does he really have? James says, I'll tell you what you really have. Number one, you've got a pile of rotten grain. A pile of rotten grain. You see that expression? Your riches are corrupted. Back then, a man's wealth was often calculated on the basis of his harvest. How much he had in the elevator. And you could have a big pile of grain, but James says it's corrupted. It is rotten grain. And you've got this big wardrobe of expensive, fancy clothes. What have you got? You've got food for bugs. Moth-eaten clothes. And you got a pile of gold and silver. What do you have? You've got rusty metal. Now that's how we ought to look at worldly wealth. Rotten grain, moth-eaten clothes, and rusty metal. And when you look at money and wealth that way, isn't it amazing how people will knock themselves out trying to get a bigger pile of rotten grain, moth-eaten clothes, and rusty metal than the next guy? What James does throughout this epistle is to take the blinders off us to where we stop looking at things around us the way the world does and look at things around us the way God does. And so back to verse 3. He says, the rusty metal is going to testify you and will eat your flesh like fire. That's what greed does to the greedy person is someone whose flesh is rotting away. If we were looking properly at greed, we would see it as a body, a human, whose flesh is rotting away. There's a famous scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark. If you've seen that, there at the end. The German official finally gets the Ark of the Covenant. He's going to take the top off and look inside. Remember that scene? And he looks inside and his face just melts away. That's exactly the picture James is describing when he talks about this metal, your greed, your love of money will eat your flesh like fire. And then he adds, you have heaped up treasure in the last days. Can you imagine winning the lottery the day before you die? You win the lottery, you're so excited, you're ecstatic, and before you know it, you're dead. That's how long you have to enjoy it. James said in chapter 4, our life is but a vapor. We're here for a little while, and then we're gone. No matter how much money you have in this world, you're not going to be able to enjoy it very long. Temporal, limited. That's the picture of greed that James wants us to see. Now, with all of that said, there are three characteristics of greed, of the love of money, that James is going to give us. Doesn't matter that we've been baptized. Doesn't matter our name is on a church membership somewhere. Doesn't matter we attend worship every time the doors are open. Doesn't matter. Here are three deeper tests to determine whether we've been taken over by greed, by the love of money. The first test is the test of injustice. Look at verse 4. The wages of the laborers who have mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud. You hired somebody to work for you, they came and did their job, and you didn't pay them what you said you'd pay them. You didn't pay them what their labor is worth. The laborer is worthy of his hire. You didn't pay him what his labor is worth. It's amazing how rich people are adept and skilled at cheating the have-nots. How the haves are so good at cheating the have-nots. Have you ever looked at a phone bill or your plane ticket or your energy bill, and it breaks down how much you're paying each month for this and that, and you start looking, and there are things in there that you have no idea what they're talking about, that you're paying for. And there have been some people who have challenged the phone company and the airlines and the power company and found out that what these big multi-billion dollar companies have been doing is adding charges here and there that are nothing. You know, a couple bucks here, a couple bucks. When you're billing a million people, a couple of extra bucks a month from each one of them, that adds up, doesn't it? And that's what they've been doing. There's a famous song in the musical Les Mis called Master of the House, sung by a fellow who owns a flea-bitten hotel. And in the song, he talks about all that he's doing to gouge his customers. And there's a great line where he sings, "Everything has a little price. Charge him for the lice, extra for the mice, 2% for looking in the mirror twice." Just every little way you can add a charge to them. Let me tell you another song that maybe more of you are familiar with than Master of the House. 16 Tons. 16 Tons. Tennessee Ernie Ford. "Tell St. Peter that I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store." These mining companies not so long ago that often had mines in the middle of nowhere in Appalachia and other places where there weren't Walmarts all around and easy access to malls and outlets, they would set up a company store. And so they'd pay the miner, and then the miner would take the money they had just gotten from the company and go to the company store and buy their groceries and buy their clothes and buy their furniture. And the company just kept all that, the coal company kept all that money to themselves. Now that's injustice. And that's what James is talking about. And notice that James skips over a step in all of this. He talks about what the rich are due. They are committing fraud. The word translated fraud here is just the word that means to rob. You are robbing people. The rich young ruler asked Christ, "What commandment should I keep?" One of the ones Christ mentioned was, "Do not defraud anybody. Don't steal. Don't rob from people." So James talks about what the rich are doing, and he skips over the step about how that was affecting people. He doesn't talk about how bad things are in Appalachia. He doesn't talk about the fact that people work all week and still don't have enough money to pay their bills or buy groceries. No, James goes straight to heaven in verse 4. "The cries of the people you have defrauded have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth." God in heaven hears when there's injustice on earth. When someone's been cheated, someone's been robbed, taken advantage of, God hears that. We think we're getting away. The rich think they're getting away with something. They're getting away with nothing. God hears that. He is called here the Lord of Sabaoth. The word Sabaoth means host. That's talking about an army battalion. The God who has battalions after battalions to command, who's following Him, He's going to unleash them on you rich folks. If they'd understand that in verse 1, maybe they'd understood why they needed to be weeping and howling for what's coming. Injustice in our dealings with people is evidence of greed in our heart. Secondly, James talks about indulgence. Look at verse 5, where he says, "You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter." We call people fat cats. People indulging themselves in pleasure, indulging themselves in luxury. But all they're doing is fattening themselves for the slaughter. This phrase translated "living in luxury" only appears here in the New Testament. They were living lives of extravagance, lives of opulence. That rich man in the story of Lazarus, he was clothed in purple, fine linen. The text says he lived sumptuously. And he's got Lazarus outside his gate dying of starvation. Hoarding can be a sin. Look at verse 2. Again, "Your riches are corrupted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver are corroded, and you have heaped up treasure." They were heaping up treasure. They were hoarding. Christ was asked in the Gospel of Luke by a guy to settle a dispute between him and his brother. Christ says, "No, I'm not getting involved in that." You know, if the Lord doesn't get involved in family feuds, we need to be very careful about getting ourselves involved in a family feud that we have nothing to do with. Christ says, "No, I'm not going to do that." But Christ tells a story about a man who had a bumper crop. This man's the exact opposite of the prodigal. He's a farmer, apparently a hard worker. He has a bumper crop. Nothing said about him being an alcoholic. Nothing said about him being a gambler, cheating on his wife, mistress on the side. Nothing said about him being irreligious. He's like so many around Gibson here, a hard-working farmer, and he has a bumper crop. And what does he do? He heaps up treasure. His cribs aren't big enough to hold what he produced. "I'll tear those down. I'll put up bigger cribs." Now, if there was a guy like that in this neighborhood that we know, you know what we'd be saying about him? He's a good farmer. He really knows how to work the land. Not only that, but he's careful with his money. He doesn't blow it. He doesn't waste it like the prodigal who wasted every last dime he had. That's what we would say about a man like that who heaped up treasure. You know what Christ said about that man? "You fool." And the reason hoarding is an act of a fool, the act of a fool, is because Christ doesn't let a man have a bumper crop simply because he went to college and got a degree in agriculture and is a better farmer than anybody else. That's not why Abraham became so rich. Genesis 12, Abraham was blessed by God to become rich so that Abraham could bless others. And when our earnings get no farther than ourselves and are not used to bless others, that is indulgence. That indicates we're greedy. And we don't understand why God has blessed us like He has. And then the third test in verse 6 is inhumanity. And boy, look at the language here. Verse 6, "You have condemned, you have murdered the just." James is writing to Christians. He's writing to Jewish Christians. Jews are often associated with money, making money. And he's writing to these people, and he says, you have murdered. I don't think that means they've gone out and shot anybody. I think it means like James is talking in chapter 4, verse 4, when he tells this same group of people, you are adulterers and adulteresses. When we make friends with the world, and we're more into the world than we are into God, and we're more taken up with living in luxury and getting excess and all that goes with that, James says God considers that adultery. And when we're unwilling to use what God's given us to bless others, God considers that murder. Now, we might not call it that. God calls it murder. When somebody's life is harder than it need be because we're stingy and unwilling to help them. So if we live for ourselves, this life is all there is. You better live it to the full because there won't be anything beyond. If this life is all you have to look forward to, then you're a fool, Christ says. And verse 17, chapter 4. To him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. When we know better than to be unjust with people, than to be self-indulgent, than to treat others inhumanely, we know better than all that, but we don't follow through, then we certainly have fallen into a terrible sin, the love of money, and there's no telling what will come out of our life as a result. So James pulls no punches in talking about the sins against humility. Every saint has a past. Every sinner has a future. Every saint has things that he's ashamed of in his past. He's got skeletons hanging there in the closet that he hopes no one ever finds out about. Every saint has a past. But every sinner has a future if they, like the thief on the cross, will turn to Christ, put their faith in Him. If they, like Lazarus, trusting in God, you've got a future when this life is over. If you're here this morning and you don't really think you have a future, you can do something about that now simply by accepting God's forgiveness, by being humble enough. God hates pride. And if it's your pride that's keeping you from taking the step that reunites you in fellowship with God, you can't be saved with that mindset. Humble yourselves, and James says God will exalt you. If we can be of help to you in any way, let us know while together we stand and while we sing.